The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Chapter 24. In the face of all his handicaps, Gurgis was obliged to make the price of a lodging and of a drink every hour or two, under a penalty of freezing to death. Day after day he roamed about in the Arctic cold, his soul filled full of bitterness and despair. He saw the world of civilization then more plainly than ever he had seen it before. A world in which nothing counted but brutal might, an order devised by those who possessed it for the subjugation of those who did not. He was one of the latter. And all outdoors, all life, was to him one colossal prison, which he paced like a pent-up tiger, trying one bar after another, and finding them all beyond his power. He had lost in the fierce battle of greed, and so was doomed to be exterminated. And all society was busy to see that he did not escape the sentence. Everywhere that he turned were prison bars, and hostile eyes following him. The well-fed, sleek policemen, from whose glances he shrank, and who seemed to grip their clubs more tightly when they saw him. The saloon keepers, who never ceased to watch him while he was in their places, who were jealous of every moment he lingered after he had paid his money. The hurrying throngs upon the streets, who were deaf to his entreaties, oblivious of his very existence and savage and contemptuous, when he forced himself upon them. They had their own affairs, and there was no place for him among them. There was no place for him anywhere every direction he turned his gaze, this fact was forced upon him. Everything was built to express it to him. The residences, with their heavy walls and bolted doors, and basement windows barred with iron. The great warehouses filled with the products of the whole world, and guarded by iron shutters and heavy gates. The banks with their unthinkable billions of wealth, all buried in safes and vaults of steel. And then one day there befell Gurgis the one adventure of his life. It was late at night, and he had failed to get the price of a lodging. Snow was falling, and he had been out so long that he was covered with it, and was chilled to the bone. He was working among the theater crowds, flitting here and there, taking large chances with the police, in his desperation half hoping to be arrested. When he saw a blue coat start toward him, however, his heart failed him, and he dashed down a side street and fled a couple of blocks. When he stopped again he saw a man coming toward him, and placed himself in his path. "Please, sir," he began, in the usual formula, "will you give me the price of a lodging? I've had a broken arm, and I can't work, and I've not a cent in my pocket. I'm an honest working man, sir, and I never begged before. It's not my fault, sir." Gurgis usually went on until he was interrupted, but this man did not interrupt, and so at last he came to a breathless stop. The other had halted, and Gurgis suddenly noticed that he stood a little unsteady. "What's it you say?" he queried suddenly, in a thick voice. Gurgis began again, speaking more slowly and distinctly. Before he was half through the other put out his hand, and rested it upon his shoulder. "Poor old chappy," he said. "Been a pickup against it, hey?" Then he lurched toward Gurgis, and the hand upon his shoulder became an arm about his neck. "Up against it myself, old sport," he said. "She's a hard old world." They were close to a lamppost, and Gurgis got a glimpse of the other. He was a young fellow not much over 18, with a handsome boyish face. He wore a silk hat and a rich soft overcoat with a fur collar. And he smiled at Gurgis with benignant sympathy. "I'm hard up, too, my goofron," he said. "I've got cruel parents, or I'd set you up. Was a matter wiser? I've been in the hospital."
"Hospital?" exclaimed the young fellow, still smiling sweetly. "That's too bad. Seems my Aunt Polly's in the hospital, too. Ole auntie's been having twins. Was a matter wiz you?"
"I've got a broken arm," Gurgis began.
"So," said the other, sympathetically. "That ain't so bad, you get over that. I wish somebody'd break my arm, old chappy. Damn if I don't. Then they'd treat me better, he'd call me up, old sport.
Was it you want to?
I'm hungry, sir, said Georges. Hungry? Why don't you have some supper?
I've got no money, sir.
No money? Ho, ho, let's be chums, old boy just like me. No money, either Amos busted.
Why don't you go home, then, same's me?
I haven't any home, said Georges.
No home.
Stranger in the city, hey?
Good God, that's bad.
Better come home with me, yes, by Harry, that's the trick. You'll come home and have some supper hick with me.
Awful lonesome, nobody home.
Guv'nor gone abroad.
Bubby on's honeymoon.
Polly haven't twins, every damn soul gone away.
Nifik nif to drive a feller to drink, I say.
Only old ham standin' by, passin' plates damn thick can eat like that, no sir.
The club for me every time, my boy, I say.
But then they won't let us sleep their guv'nor's orders, by Harry home every night, sir.
Ever hear anything like that every morning do I asked him?
No, sir, every night, or no allowance at all, sir, has my guv'nor nice as nails, by Harry.
Toll O'Laham to watch me, two servants spying on me, wuzzer think that, my friend?
A nice, quiet, good-hearted young feller like me, and his daddy can't go to Europe up and leave him in peace.
Ain't that a shame, sir?
And I gotter go home every evening and miss all the fun, by Harry.
That's what's the matter now, that's why I'm here.
Had to come away and leave Kitty Hick, left her crying, too, who'd you think of that, old sport, lemme go, kittens, says I come early and often.
I go where duty Hick calls.
Farewell, farewell, my own true love, farewell, farewell, my own true love. This last was a song, and the young gentleman's voice rose mournful and wailing, while he swung upon Georges's neck. The latter was glancing about nervously, lest someone should approach. They were still alone, however.
But I came all right, continued the youngster, aggressively, I can hick.
I can have my own way when I want it, by Harry.
Freddie Jones is a hard man to handle when he gets going.
No, sir, says I, by thunder, and I don't need anybody going home with me, either. Who'd you take me for, hey?
Think I'm drunk, don't ya, hey?
I know you.
But I'm no more drunk than you are, kittens, says I to her.
And then says she, that's true, Freddie dear, she's a smart one, is Kitty, but I'm staying in the flat, and you're going out into the cold, cold night. Put it in a poem, lovely Kitty, says I, no joking, Freddie, my boy, says she, lemme call a cab now, like a good dear, but I can call my own cabs, don't fool yourself, and I know what I'm a doing, you bet say.
My friend, whatcha say, will I come home and see me, and have some supper?
Come along like a good feller, don't be haughty.
You're up against it, same as me, and you can understand a feller.
Your heart's in the right place, by Harry, come along, old chappie, and we'll light up the house, and have some fizz, and we'll raise hell, we will whoop la.
S'long's I'm inside the house I can do, as I please, the guv'nor's own very orders, God.
Hip.
Hip.
They had started down the street, arm in arm, the young man pushing Georges along, half dazed.
Georges was trying to think what to do. He knew he could not pass any crowded place with his new acquaintance without attracting attention and being stopped. It was only because of the falling snow that people who passed here did not notice anything wrong. Suddenly, therefore, Georges stopped.
Is it very far?
He inquired.
Not very, said the other, tired.
Are you, though?
Well, we'll ride, whatcha say?
Good.
Call a cab.
And then, gripping Georges tight with one hand, the young fellow began searching his pockets with the other.
You call, old sport, and I'll pay, he suggested.
How's that, hey?
And he pulled out from somewhere a big roll of bills.
It was more money than Georges had ever seen in his life before, and he stared at it with startled eyes.
Looks like a lot, hey?
Said Master Freddie, fumbling with it.
Fool you, though, old chappie, they're all little ones.
I'll be busted in 1 week more, sure thing, word of honor. And not a cent more till the first hick governor's orders hick not a cent, by Harry. Nif to set a feller crazy, it is. I sent him a cable, this afternoon past, one reason more why I'm going home. Hangin' on the verge of starvation, I says, for the honor of the family hick send me some bread. Hunger will compel me to join you. Freddy has what I wired him, by Harry, and I mean it. I'll run away from school, God, if he don't send me some. After this fashion the young gentleman continued to prattle on, and meantime Georges was trembling with excitement. He might grab that wad of bills and be out of sight in the darkness, before the other could collect his wits. Should he do it? What better had he to hope for, if he waited longer? But Georges had never committed a crime in his life, and now he hesitated half a second too long. Freddy got one bill loose, and then stuffed the rest back into his trousers pocket. "Here, old man," he said, "you take it." He held it out fluttering. They were in front of a saloon. And by the light of the window Georges saw that it was a $100 bill. "You take it," the other repeated. "Pay the cabbie and keep the change. I've got hick no head for business. Guv'nor says so hisself, and the guv'nor knows the guv'nor's got a head for business. You bet all right, guv'nor, I told him, you run the show, and I'll take the tickets." And so he said, "And Polly, to watch me hick," and now Polly's off in the hospital having twins, and me out raising Cain. "Hello, there. Hey. Call him." A cab was driving by. And Georges sprang and called, and it swung round to the curb. Master Freddy clambered in with some difficulty, and Georges had started to follow, when the driver shouted, "Hi, there. Get out, you." Georges hesitated, and was half obeying. But his companion broke out, "Was it? Was a matter with you, hey?" And the cabbie subsided, and Georges climbed in. Then Freddy gave a number on the Lakeshore Drive, and the carriage started away. The youngster leaned back and snuggled up to Georges, murmuring contentedly. In half a minute he was sound asleep. Georges sat shivering, speculating as to whether he might not still be able to get hold of the roll of bills. He was afraid to try to go through his companion's pockets, however. And besides, the cabbie might be on the watch. He had the $100 safe, and he would have to be content with that. At the end of half an hour or so the cab stopped. They were out on the waterfront, and from the east a freezing gale was blowing off the ice-bound lake. "Here we are," called the cabbie, and Georges awakened his companion. Master Freddy sat up with a start. "Hello," he said. "Where are we? Wizzies? Who are you, hey?" "Oh, yes, sure enough. Most forgot you hick a late chappie. Home, are we? Lessee. Brrr, it's cold. Yes, come long, we're home at ever so hick humble." Before them there loomed an enormous granite pile, set far back from the street, and occupying a whole block. By the light of the driveway lamps Georges could see that it had towers and huge gables, like a medieval castle. He thought that the young fellow must have made a mistake. It was inconceivable to him that any person could have a home like a hotel or the city hall. But he followed in silence, and they went up the long flight of steps, arm in arm. "There's a button here, old sport," said Master Freddy. "Hold my arm while I find her. Steady, now. Oh, yes, here she is. Saved." A bell rang, and in a few seconds the door was opened. A man in blue livery stood holding it, and gazing before him, silent as a statue. They stood for a moment blinking in the light. Then Georges felt his companion pulling, and he stepped in, and the blue automaton closed the door. Georges's heart was beating wildly. It was a bold thing for him to do, and to what strange unearthly place he was venturing he had no idea. Aladdin entering his cave could not have been more excited. The place where he stood was dimly lighted. But he could see a vast hall,
with pillars fading into the darkness above, and a great staircase opening at the far end of it. The floor was of tessellated marble, smooth as glass, and from the walls strange shapes loomed out, woven into huge portieres in rich, harmonious colors, or gleaming from paintings, wonderful and mysterious looking in the half-light, purple and red and golden, like sunset glimmers in a shadowy forest. The man in livery had moved silently toward them. Master Freddy took off his hat and handed it to him, and then, letting go of George's arm, tried to get out of his overcoat. After two or three attempts he accomplished this, with the lackey's help, and meantime a second man had approached, a tall and portly personage, solemn as an executioner. He bore straight down upon Georges, who shrank away nervously. He seized him by the arm without a word, and started toward the door with him. Then suddenly came Master Freddy's voice, "Hamilton! My friend will remain with me." The man paused and half-released Georges. "Come along, old chappie," said the other, and Georges started toward him. "Master Frederick!" exclaimed the man. "See that the cabihic is paid," was the other's response. And he linked his arm in Georges. Georges was about to say, "I have the money for him," but he restrained himself. The stout man in uniform signaled to the other, who went out to the cab, while he followed Georges and his young master. They went down the great hall, and then turned. Before them were two huge doors. "Hamilton," said Master Freddy.
"Well, sir?"
said the other.
"What's the matter with dining room doors?"
"Nothing is the matter, sir."
"Then why don't open 'em?"
The man rolled them back. Another vista lost itself in the darkness. "Lights," commanded Master Freddy. And the butler pressed a button, and a flood of brilliant incandescence streamed from above, half-blinding Georges. He stared. And little by little he made out the great apartment, with a domed ceiling from which the light poured, and walls that were one enormous painting, nymphs and dryads dancing in a flower-strewn glade. Diana with her hounds and horses, dashing headlong through a mountain streamlet, a group of maidens bathing in a forest pool all life-size, and so real that Georges thought that it was some work of enchantment, that he was in a dream palace. Then his eye passed to the long table in the center of the hall, a table black as ebony, and gleaming with wrought silver and gold. In the center of it was a huge carven bowl, with a glistening gleam of ferns and the red and purple of rare orchids, glowing from a light hidden somewhere in their midst. "This is the dining room," observed Master Freddy. "How you like it, hey, old sport?" He always insisted on having an answer to his remarks, leaning over Georges and smiling into his face. Georges liked it. "Rummy old place to feed in all alone, though," was Freddy's comment. "Rummy's hell. What's you think, hey?" Then another idea occurred to him and he went on, without waiting. "Maybe you never saw an Ethan Hick like this for? Hey, old chappie?"
"No," said Georges.
"Come from country, maybe, hey?"
"Yes," said Georges.
"Aha. I though so. Lots of folks from country never saw such a place. Governor brings and free show hick regular circus. Go home tell folks about it. Old man loans his place loans the Packer Beef Trust man. Made it all out of house, too, damn old scoundrel. Now we see where our pennies go rebates, and private car lines hick by Harry. Bully place, though worth seein'. Ever hear of loans the Packer, hey, old chappie?"
Georges had started involuntarily. The other, whose sharp eyes missed nothing, demanded.
"What's the matter, hey? Heard of him?" And Georges managed to stammer out. "I have worked for him in the yards."
"What?" cried Master Freddy, with a yell.
"You! In the yards? Ho, ho! Why, say, that's good. Shake hands on it, old man by Harry. Governor ought to be here glad to see you. Great friends with the men, Governor Labor and Capital, Community Interests, and all the hick. Funny things happen in this world, don't they, old man?"
Hamilton, lemme introduce you from the family Olay from the Guvner's works in the yards. Come to spend the night with me, Hamilton have a hot time.
Me from, mister, what's your name, old chappie? Tell us your name.
Rudicus.
Georgius Rudicus.
My friend, Mr. Rednose, Hamilton shake hands.
The stately butler bowed his head, but made not a sound.
And suddenly Master Freddy pointed an eager finger at him.
I know what's a matter with you, Hamilton lay you a dollar I know.
You think I'm drunk.
Hey, now?
And the butler again bowed his head.
Yes, sir, he said. At which Master Freddy hung tightly upon Georgius's neck, and went into a fit of laughter.
Hamilton, you damn old scoundrel, he roared, I'll charge you for impudence, you see if I don't.
Ho, 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 I'm drunk.
Ho, ho.
The two waited until his fit had spent itself, to see what new whim would seize him.
Whatcha wanna do?
He queried suddenly.
Wanna see the place, old chappie?
Won't play the Guvner show you rune?
State parlors.
Louis cans.
Louis says chairs cost 3,000 o piece.
Tea room mirror and knit picture of shepherds dancing.
Ruisdale 23,000.
Ballroom balcony pillars hick imported special ship 68,000.
Ceiling painted in Rome was 8 fellers name, Hamilton.
Metatani?
Macaroni?
Then this place sober.
Benvenuto Cellini Romy Old Ego.
And the organ $30,000, sir starter up, Hamilton, let Mr. Rednose hear it.
No never mind clean forgot says he's hungry, Hamilton let's have some supper.
Only hick don't let's have it here come up to my place, old sport nice and cozy.
This way steady now, don't slip on the floor.
Hamilton, we'll have a coal spread, and some fizz don't leave out the fizz, by Harry.
We'll have some of the 1830 Madeira.
Hear me, sir?
Yes, sir, said the butler, but, Master Frederick, your father left orders.
And Master Frederick drew himself up to a stately height.
My father's orders were left to me hick and not to you, he said.
Then, clasping Georgius tightly by the neck, he staggered out of the room.
On the way another idea occurred to him, and he asked.
Any cable message for me, Hamilton?
No, sir, said the butler.
Guvner must be travelin'.
And how's the twins, Hamilton?
They are doing well, sir.
Good,
said Master Freddy.
And added fervently,
God bless him, the little lambs.
They went up the great staircase, one step at a time.
At the top of it there gleamed at them out of the shadows the figure of a nymph crouching by a fountain, a figure ravishingly beautiful, the flesh warm and glowing with the hues of life.
Above was a huge court, with domed roof, the various apartments opening into it.
The butler had paused below but a few minutes to give orders, and then followed them.
Now he pressed a button, and the hall blazed with light.
He opened a door before them, and then pressed another button. As they staggered into the apartment,
it was fitted up as a study.
In the center was a mahogany table, covered with books and smoker's implements. The walls were decorated with college trophies and colors flags, posters, photographs and knick-knacks, tennis rackets, canoe paddles, golf clubs, and polo sticks. An enormous moose head, with horns 6 feet across, faced a buffalo head on the opposite wall, while bear and tiger skins covered the polished floor. There were lounging chairs and sofas, window seats covered with soft cushions of fantastic designs. There was one corner fitted in Persian fashion, with a huge canopy and a jeweled lamp beneath. Beyond, a door opened upon a bedroom, and beyond that was a swimming pool of the purest marble, that had cost about $40,000.
Master Freddy stood for a moment or two, gazing about him.
Then out of the next room a dog emerged, a monstrous bulldog, the most hideous object that Georgius had ever laid eyes upon. He yawned, opening a mouth like a dragon's, and he came toward the young man, wagging his tail.
"Hello, Dewey!" cried his master. Been having a snooze, old boy?
Well, hello there. What does that matter?
The dog was snarling at Georges.
Why, do we this my friend, Mr. Rednose Ole friend the Gubner's.
Mr. Rednose, Admiral Dewey.
Shake hands, hick. Ain't he a daisy, though blue ribbon at the New York show 8500 at a clip.
How's that, hey?
The speaker sank into one of the big armchairs, and Admiral Dewey crouched beneath it. He did not snarl again, but he never took his eyes off Georges. He was perfectly sober, was the Admiral. The butler had closed the door, and he stood by it, watching Georges every second. Now there came footsteps outside, and, as he opened the door, a man in livery entered, carrying a folding table, and behind him two men with covered trays. They stood like statues while the first spread the table and set out the contents of the trays upon it. There were cold pates, and thin slices of meat, tiny bread and butter sandwiches with a crust cut off, a bowl of sliced peaches and cream in January, little fancy cakes, pink and green and yellow and white, and half a dozen ice-cold bottles of wine.
"That's the stuff for you,"
cried Master Freddy, exultantly, as he spied them.
"Come along, old chappie, move up."
And he seated himself at the table. The waiter pulled a cork, and he took the bottle, and poured three glasses of its contents in succession down his throat. Then he gave a long-drawn sigh, and cried again to Georges to seat himself. The butler held the chair at the opposite side of the table, and Georges thought it was to keep him out of it. But finally he understood that it was the other's intention to put it under him, and so he sat down, cautiously and mistrustingly. Master Freddy perceived that the attendants embarrassed him, and he remarked with a nod to them, "You may go." They went, all save the butler.
"You may go too, Hamilton," he said.
"Master Frederick," the man began.
"Go,"
cried the youngster, angrily.
"Damn you, don't you hear me?"
The man went out and closed the door. Georges, who was as sharp as he, observed that he took the key out of the lock, in order that he might peer through the keyhole. Master Frederick turned to the table again.
"Now," he said, "go for it."
Georges gazed at him doubtingly.
"Eat,"
cried the other.
"Pile in, old chappie."
"Don't you want anything?"
Georges asked.
"Ain't hungry," was the reply.
"Only thirsty.
Kitty and me had some candy, you go on."
So Georges began, without further parley. He ate as with two shovels, his fork in one hand and his knife in the other. When he once got started, his wolf hunger got the better of him, and he did not stop for breath until he had cleared every plate.
"Gee whiz," said the other, who had been watching him in wonder. Then he held Georges the bottle.
"Lessy, you drink now," he said.
And Georges took the bottle, and turned it up to his mouth, and a wonderfully unearthly liquid ecstasy poured down his throat, tickling every nerve of him, thrilling him with joy. He drank the very last drop of it, and then he gave vent to a long-drawn,
"Good stuff, hey?"
said Freddy, sympathetically. He had leaned back in the big chair, putting his arm behind his head and gazing at Georges. And Georges gazed back at him. He was clad in spotless evening dress, was Freddy, and looked very handsome. He was a beautiful boy, with light golden hair and the head of an ananas. He smiled at Georges confidingly, and then started talking again, with his blissful insouciance. This time he talked for 10 minutes at a stretch, and in the course of the speech he told Georges all of his family history. His big brother He Is Not Busy was in love with a guileless maiden, who played the part of Little Bright Eyes in The Caliph of Kamskatka. He had been on the verge of marrying her once, only the governor had sworn to disinherit him, and had presented him with a sum that would stagger the imagination, and that had staggered the virtue of Little Bright Eyes. Now He Is Not Busy had got leave from college, and had gone away in his automobile on the next best thing to a honeymoon. The governor had made threats to disinherit another of his children also, sister Gwendolyn, who had married an Italian marquis with a string of titles and a dueling record. They lived in his chateau, or rather had, until he had taken to firing the breakfast dishes at her. Then she had cabled for help, and the old gentleman had gone over to find out what were his grace's terms. So they had left Freddy all alone, and he with less than $2,000 in his pocket. Freddy was up in arms and meant serious business, as they would find in the end. If there was no other way of bringing them to terms, he would have his kins wire that she was about to marry him, and see what happened then. So the cheerful youngster rattled on, until he was tired out. He smiled his sweetest smile at Georges, and then he closed his eyes, sleepily. Then he opened them again, and smiled once more, and finally closed them and forgot to open them. For several minutes Georges sat perfectly motionless, watching him, and reveling in the strange sensation of the champagne. Once he stirred, and the dog growled. After that he sat almost holding his breath until after a while the door of the room opened softly, and the butler came in. He walked toward Georges upon tiptoe, scowling at him. And Georges rose up, and retreated, scowling back. So until he was against the wall, and then the butler came close, and pointed toward the door. "Get out of here," he whispered. Georges hesitated, giving a glance at Freddy, who was snoring softly. "If you do, you son of a," hissed the butler, "I'll mash in your face for you before you get out of here." And Georges wavered but an instant more. He saw Admiral Dewey coming up behind the man and growling softly, to back up his threats. Then he surrendered and started toward the door. They went out without a sound, and down the great echoing staircase, and through the dark hall. At the front door he paused, and the butler strode close to him. "Hold up your hands," he snarled. Georges took a step back, clenching his one well fist. "What for?" he cried. And then understanding that the fellow proposed to search him, he answered, "I'll see you in hell first." "Do you want to go to jail?" demanded the butler, menacingly. "I'll have the police." "Have 'em," roared Georges, with fierce passion. "But you won't put your hands on me till you do. I haven't touched anything in your damned house, and I'll not have you touch me." So the butler, who was terrified lest his young master should waken, stepped suddenly to the door, and opened it. "Get out of here," he said. And then as Georges passed through the opening, he gave him a ferocious kick that sent him down the great stone steps at a run, and landed him sprawling in the snow at the bottom.